this is Dr. Bob Evans, and welcome to our podcast, Parental Alienation from Couch to Courtroom and Beyond. We will discuss the resisting and refusing dynamic, commonly referred to as parental alienation, how you'll know it's happening in your case, and what can be done about it. Parental alienation can cause stress and trauma in high-conflict cases. These podcasts focus on how attorneys and mental health professionals can support families and children. Well, today we have a special guest, and we're going to do a conversation and interview with Dr. J. Michael Bone, who is a well-known and respected professional in the field of parental alienation. And Dr. Bone does a lot of consultation, mostly with attorneys and pro se litigants. I suppose consultations with represented litigants as well. But anyway, I thought I would bring Mike on, talk about the topic of parental alienation.
Morning, all right, very Mike. Good. Bob, thank you. I appreciate it. And Bob, as you know, we've worked together, been friends for maybe 30 years now. So we go way back. So
it's true. That's true.
We've done a lot of work together. What I wanted to do is one of the things I want to say stumbled across, but it's been several years in the making, is how's the best way to present a parental alienation case to the court? I mean, the court has such a great likelihood of getting it wrong. What does one need to do? How does one need to present it in a way that'll lessen the chance the court will get it wrong? And the first question might be, wait a minute, what is a mental health professional doing talking about litigation strategy? He's not a lawyer. Well, you're quite right. I'm not a lawyer. But there's something unique about the whole parental alienation phenomenon. And that is, and we've learned this from research over several years, that there's a high incidence of certain personality disorders. So the reason I'm focused on this is because the qualities of those personality disorders are exactly the same thing that will expose what they're actually doing. Because alienating parents, if they're asked the question, do you support the relationship between the children and the other parent, they will always say yes, because they know that's the right answer. However, what they're doing is engaging in behaviors that actually try to sabotage that relationship.
But one of the things, Mike, that you have to do is you're going to be coaching an attorney,
right,
in terms of trying to elicit that information so the court can hear it.
Exactly. And
that's either going to come from an expert, or it's going to come from a litigant or right. A witness of some sort. Maybe exactly. It's a custodial evaluator, whatever.
Right. Exactly.
So how do you do that? I mean, how?
Okay. Well, the first thing I would, as you know, Bob, as many of the, I'm sure, listeners know, I mean, the research done by Amy Baker and Paul Fine identifying 17 empirically validated behaviors engaged in by alienating parents, I sort of send that as a template to the client and to the attorney and say, here's the template to be able to put all the evidence that shows these various violations, like contact blocking, bad mouthing, all the things that we know happen. So by having specific evidentiary proof, if you will, of those things, that's what we want to capture first, because we know, because of the nature of the personality types or disorders that are typical in alienating parents, we know that they're going to lie about what they're actually doing. So that's what's unique about this phenomenon and how to present it in court is it has a predictable pattern to it. They will predictably lie about claiming to be supportive of the relationship, but then identifying, exposing the reality of what's going on. And but here's the significant thing. So let's say now the alienating parent is being cross-examined by an attorney and they have evidence that shows that what they just said wasn't true. But here's the thing. People with these personality disorders, they really tend to believe their own distortions. So to them, they're not really lying. They're being truthful. But to the rest of the world or in the courtroom who's watching this, they see something very different. So people with these disorders will keep doing it. And that's when people, as I like to say, when people in the courtroom start looking around at each other like, oh, I see what's going on here. So it's a matter of exposing the truth of that. And what I have found is that It's basically, I mean, not being a lawyer, never went to law school, but it seems like to me, from what I do know about it, it's sort of like litigation 101. I mean, the purpose of litigation in getting testimony is to identify the truth teller from the untruth teller, and that's really what this is. So being able to identify that, and then the way the alienating parent will handle it will be different than if you or I were accused of just telling a lie. Because what is a normal reaction to if you're told, "Oh, you just lied," "Oh, you misunderstood," or "No, I didn't really mean that," or "Oh, I'm sorry, I lied for this." But these people don't do that. They keep on doing it, not realizing that they're actually lying, and the rest of the courtroom begins, and that's when the mask comes off. So this is a very, I mean, this is a very, in my opinion, a very efficient strategy to be able to do this. I mean, I first, as I said earlier, sort of stumbled on this when I was involved in this fairly high-profile case, and it ended up working out well because we really had a lot of information about the alienating parent's psychological makeup. And we didn't, in that particular case, we didn't even use the term parental alienation because the behaviors engaged in, these 17 behaviors, no judge would ever look kindly on. So it's a matter of just showing that, because what the alienating parent will claim to be just the opposite of what they actually are. And that's what has to be exposed. And
And
that is the lion's share of it.
I think one of the things too that we see is virtually every state has some factors that a court's supposed to consider, and
Yes.
almost universally, one of the factors is to what extent or parents are encouraged to facilitate the relationship between one parent and the other parent. And so you have a parent coming in and saying just what you're saying, yeah, of course I want the other parent to have a relationship with the child, and then they're confronted with, yeah, but you're doing X, Y, and Z, and it's sort of and they kind of go on. It's like
Yes.
I remember years and years and years ago, I had a case where it was probably one of the first times that I was supposed to do a reunification with somebody, and it was a different case than you and I worked on, and I recorded all my sessions. I have continued to always do that, re video record my sessions. And so this mother comes in with the child, and she's trashing the other parent. She's trashing the father in front of the child. And I said, "Whoa, whoa, wait a minute! You can't really do this in front of Johnny here. Johnny, I'm going to have Johnny go out to the reception area, and there's some toys out there for Johnny to play with." And I came back and I said, "You can't talk like that in front of your child." And she said, "Well, what are you talking about?" I said, "Well, let me show you," because she knew I was recording the session. I played back
Wow.
what she said. And she goes, and halfway through the playback, she goes, You see what
Yes.
he's like? You see the
Yes.
things that he does?" And it goes, she totally, it was
She saw something different than what everybody else
a
saw.
different reality, totally
Exactly.
different reality.
In a case many, many years ago, I'm sure we've talked about this in the past, there was an alienating parent, and we had very good video evidence of this, and the alienating parent was on the video. It was very unambiguous. I don't even recall, it was so long ago, I don't recall exactly what was on it. But the significant thing was when the thing was rolled out and played for the whole courtroom, the judge and the attorneys and so on and so forth, as this incident is happening, this particular parent is pointing at the screen. You see what he did? You see, nobody else saw anything like that. So then, to make it even more so, I said, "Well, this is interesting. Would you be willing to do this interview again, not in the court, but with a polygrapher, hook her up to a polygraph," which was done. And guess what? It came out. I mean, polygraphs don't determine lie, it determines deception. And so intentional deception. So guess what? It came out. No deception. She believed, I mean, they believed. That's what's important to remember. They believe, and that makes them very persuasive, doesn't it? Because they believe that it's what their distorted assumption is the truth, and it is for them, even though it may not be true in reality.
But isn't the challenge that you have? I mean, there's such a variety of attorneys out there. So it's
Oh
a
yeah.
kind of the challenge for you in terms of consulting with an attorney to do this type of strategy is to get them on board.
Yeah,
Now,
exactly.
and some of them are on board. Some of
Yeah.
them have a sense of what's going on.
There are three different, to me, there are three different categories. You got the onboard category, You got the, I don't need anybody to tell me what to do as far as you got that category, which is not very common. But it does happen. And then you got the third category is, well, I'm going to tolerate this guy, but I'm not really going to take it very seriously. So what I try to do is have the show the attorney that really doing it this way is a lot more efficient. It makes his job or her job a lot easier because I'm going to go through and sort of filter out a lot of the stuff because the goal is to really focus almost exclusively just on the alienating parents' behavior.
Right.
I mean, if we were having this conversation 15 years ago, Bob, I would say, oh no, you have to show this and all these other things, five or six different points. Well, you really don't. If you just focus on that, so much more efficient, so much more direct. And expert testimony could be helpful, and not necessarily, but it could be to explain to the court how serious these behaviors are and how what an ill effect it will have on the child. So
Right.
it's, but you're right. I mean, once the attorney sort of realizes, wait a minute, we're speaking the same language. I'm going to help deliver along with the client the evidence that shows and sort of educate the attorney to that these are, I hate to say it like this, predictable liars. They will claim that they're doing one thing when they're doing something to the opposite. And once I get them to understand that, then this all tends to fall in place.
I think complicating the issue too is this is such an emotionally charged phenomenon for the litigant, for the rejected parent, that they want to tell a story. They want you to know what they've gone through. They want you to know that how what kind of a horrendous experience that they had. In some cases, we're talking about parents who haven't seen their children for years.
Years, yes.
And they're just totally devastated by this. And so they want you to know how horrible this has been. And
Yes.
so it's difficult sometimes. I know when somebody hires me as an expert witness, I will have them complete a five-factor model where they go through the five factors that the child's resisting or rejecting them, that they've had a previous loving relationship, that they've not been proven to be abusive or neglectful. Then they include the 17 strategies from Amy Baker and the eight symptoms of parental alienation and provide me with evidence to show that as an expert witness, I can then address those in my testimony. And that's the way the case should be presented to the court. Now,
Yes.
again, not an attorney, but instead of looking at, what horrible experiences that this person has gone through and the children.
Yes.
And so it's important that we have the end goal is to help the judge understand what's going on in this case. And
Right. Exactly.
you got your three characterizations of an attorney. Well, you got three characterizations of a judge, don't you?
Yes.
You got
Yes, you
one that's
do.
open to it, you got the one that doesn't, well, I'll tolerate this guy until he gets done with his testimony, and he'll give the client their give the litigant their day in court, and then it's like, well, I'll listen to this guy, but it's inconsequential.
I'm glad you brought that up, Bob. That's a very important point I wanted to make also in this conversation. And that is how to best present this. I think there are some tactics that can be used by parents. And sort of coaching them about how to testify, not to alter anything or modify anything, but how do you tell the story? And I think this is an important thing because one of the things we need to do is to engage the judge emotionally. We have to get the judge upset about what they understand to be going on. And again, those 17 behaviors are the formula to do so. But how do you do that? And what I explain to the client and to the attorney is in my thinking, there's two kinds of evidence. There's what I call tier one and tier two. Tier one is the indisputable stuff that can expose the lie, so to speak. And then tier two is more he said, she said. What I have found is if you have a foundation of tier one, not that many, three or four or five maybe like that, then tier two evidence is still very persuasive because it's sitting on a foundation of really indisputable stuff. So when the client or the parent is being questioned, being given, tell me about your relationship with your child at age 4 or something like that. What we want to do before that is to select a specific incident, sort of a what I call sort of a specimen example of the relationship. And you look for those in the evidence or in the parent's direct description. Because if I describe an incident and the person is listening, if I'd said, oh, I went to the store and I did this and that, the person listening in some way has to sort of picture it to follow the story. So, but that's how we access the judge's emotional system. The limbic system is by basically telling a story that gets them emotionally engaged. And that's what gets the judge
So
engaged.
the story is what? A positive relationship.
Yes. And that's the other part of this. I mean, part of there really, the model that I'm advocating for is really has two parts, and we're just talking about one of them. That is exposure of the alienating parent's behavior. That's really critical. But the other part is also important. The targeted parent has been falsely vilified in some way, in every way, maybe in some particular cases. So there's this cloud of suspicion that's been hovering over them. So I always advocate during the targeted parent's direct testimony that it sort of go on and on, that they really explain the depth of their relationship. And so there was a case many years ago where there was a father who was a targeted parent, and he was one of those parents that was, he had five kids. He took, was very involved in their lives, but he also just liked kids. I mean, they lived in Colorado at the time, and he would take teach handicapped kids how to ski. He was like a guy like that. So he had all these artifacts, these trophies, these awards, these things that he got in appreciation. So we had him bring them and just set them on the table. And then and during his the questioning of him, they'd be referenced just to make a visual, a sort of visceral kind of presentation about who this guy really, he's not the guy that's being described by the alienating parent at all. So we have to get the judge comfortable with who that person really is. So obviously do more direct testimony than you think you need to, because you have to really paint a powerful picture that so the judge goes, well, this seemed like a decent person, a decent parent. What the hell happened? And then we notice that all the changes happen not on his or her, not on the targeted parent's watch, but on the alienating parent's watch. And that will become obvious when the evidence comes out in that testimony.
So details.
Yes, details are very important. If I say, oh, so and so is abusive, that has one kind of level of understanding. But if I say someone's abusive, and then I give you a specific example of that, on this date, this happened and he did this, that's visceral. And that creates a picture in your head. So if you leave it on the abstract level, you're not going to access that. And so that's what we have to do is really make things very concrete and very detailed so we can access, make it visceral.
Well,
I've often said, I think family court has more to do with theater than it does with law. It has to do with persuasion and making a good presentation. And that's what, if you think about it, that's what alienating parents are really good at. They're good at appearing one way and then being another way, because that's the nature of those personality disorders.
Elizabeth Loftus talks about how words really matter.
Yes.
And so the description and the details and the adjectives become very, very critical.
Yes.
And so that's part of the painting of the picture for that visual image that you're trying to create.
Exactly. Exactly. Because we want to put the judge in the position. See, if you don't develop that robust, positive picture of the targeted parent before the separation, before the alienation, or whatever. If you don't do that, there's a chance the judge may think, oh, this has always been a problem. And it will just assume that. So you have to not allow the judge to think that. You have to create a very a visceral, vivid, robust picture of how positive to put the judge in the position to go, wait a minute, what happened here? This guy had, or this person, mother or father, had a great relationship with their kid now, and now they don't. I mean, so
How does that
you have to
happen?
put the judge in that position.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen naturally between
No.
a parent and a child. That just
No.
doesn't happen that way. I think one of the
Exactly.
things that's coming to my mind too is the whole idea of not only being explicit in your language, but disavowing or dis, I guess that's a good word, getting rid of this concept of a high conflict divorce.
Yes.
Because that is constantly brought up. This is a
Yes.
high conflict divorce, Your Honor. Well, the implication immediately is that both parents are out of control.
I
And
think that's a,
they might
yes.
both be emotionally involved, but it's not that this the alienation is not an equal distribution.
Right.
The fallacy of the hybrid model
Yes.
Okay. You know, oh boy, mental health people who hear this is going to go, they're going to be going crazy because, you know, there are cases where both parents are guilty. Well, there may be,
Yeah.
but the idea is if you really drill down and you find out that the preponderance of evidence is going to suggest that some person or group of people, because it could be the extended family,
Sure.
are actually influencing the child away from that other parent. The targeted parent is not perfect. They make
Right.
mistakes. They do stupid things. They do things that doesn't help their case all the time. But
Right.
the tipping point is hardly ever in their direction in that sense.
Exactly. Exactly. And like I like to say, the necess we know the necessary ingredient to create alienation, and that is alienating behavior on the part of that parent.
Yeah.
And it can be that you can have two alienating parents, but in my experience, that is statistically rare. And also one more point that just echoes what you said a moment ago, Bob, and that is, I really think the default setting for family law judges is to assume, and they're trained this way too, I believe, that they're assume that both parties are somehow equally responsible for the problem. And that's probably true in most cases, but in cases of alienation, it really is not true, or it's rarely true. I mean, it really, so you have to show how they're different. So you have to show that they're not, you know, I've heard judges say, and I know you have too, Bob, you know, oh, these two just hate each other more than they love their children. And while that's possible, that is not what's going on in an alienation case. And being
Right.
able to show how different these parents, exposing the behavior over here, the alienating parent, and then exposing the truth of the relationship with the targeted parent, that we have to make that, you have to really break that apart and show how
And
different they are.
I think it's so frequently misunderstood and inconceivable to most people that a parent would do that to a child
Yes.
because typically, what you see is the focus is always between the adults. And it's
Yeah.
sort of like, well, one is so angry or resentful of the other one. So therefore, they're going to do anything they can to hurt that person. And of
Yeah.
course, the sharpest instrument you can use to hurt them is going to be the child. So
Of course.
if I can influence and reinforce the child away from that parent, that's going to really hurt that person.
Yeah.
And that's the maniacal, the psychopathic
Yeah.
part of the alienating parent.
Yes, I completely agree. I mean, that's what we see. What's interesting is I think Steve Miller might have been one of the first to say, you know, severe cases are different than other, and
Right.
they are, they're more severe. But this model of exposure works in every level, mild, moderate, and severe. Because even in a mild case, their parents behave, it was one. There's probably one parent doing alienating things, if that's the case, in the case of mild alienation. But so the model that exposes that still has the same effect, whether it's severe or not.
I don't disagree. I don't disagree. Can there be mild cases where, you may not have, an alienating parent on one end, where you have maybe a young child that's resisting transferring, or a young child who's engaged in play, and at that point in time doesn't really want to stop the play and go with the other parent or
Sure.
whatever. So there are, but that can be easily dealt with.
Right. That's called parenting.
It's yes, and it's sort of like that's kind of gone out the window. We are now in, I and I know there are people that will disagree with me, but now we're in an era where you have to listen to the child, and it's
Yeah.
like listening to the child has been a phenomenon that, if you historically look at it, has gotten the legal system, a lot of people, in trouble because they've been
Yeah.
listening to the child. And I frequently will testify, in 1692, you had the Salem witch trials. Well,
Yeah.
it turned out that Salem was just one place. It was all
Yes.
throughout England, the Northeast, of the United States, in the
Yes.
1600s, what this stuff was going on. And kids were doing these things,
Right.
identifying witches, and people were getting burned at the stakes, and all kinds of horrible things were happening to people.
So
Just
it's
Salem
certainly
happens to be the
important.
most recent. And
Yeah.
we're back into it now. There are now presentations through various associations on listening to the child and how we have to respect. And it's a total ignoring of the whole research by
Right.
Stephen Ceci, by all of the people that talk about children. in terms of the reliability of the testimony.
Of course.
Nobody's
But
paying
I mean,
attention to it.
You know, just to be clear, of course, it's important to listen to the child, but you have to put that in the context of the all the vast information surrounding it. You have to put the context about all, you have to evaluate all of those things. So,
Well,
yeah, of course, it's important to listen to the child, but you have to look at the big picture to
the
really
other
understand.
piece is children don't necessarily make decisions that are in their own best interest.
Of
So
course.
that's why there's a phenomenon called parenting. So that's why
Right.
we parent children, we supervise children, we steer them in a certain direction, and we steer them away from other directions. We don't
Exactly.
allow children to get engaged in gangs or drugs or that criminal activity. We
Right.
just we don't allow that.
Right. Right.
But
And if you do allow it, that's a felony, I think.
well, you have to listen to the child.
Right. I know it's again, it's important to do that, but even more important is to look listen to the whole context of everything.
Well, yeah, I mean, you take a look at the whole idea. Well, again, we're focusing on the whole idea of children rejecting a parent. And in severe cases, we're not just talking about, you know, rejection of, well, I don't want to see them anymore. In some severe cases, they want to see that parent dead. They never
Yeah.
want, I mean, it's severe.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
Well, I know you do a lot of work with attorneys, Mike. How, if attorney or a parent wanted to get in touch with you to help help with their case, how would they do that?
Well, my website's the easiest way to access it, which is www.jmichaelbone. My first name's John, but I've never gone by it. jmichaelbone.com. And then click on there and you'll click around. You'll find a button for initial consultation. That's typically the way it starts. So I'll have it may last an hour, may last 2 hours. It'll be typically with a parent, sometimes with the attorney. That changes it a little bit, but I don't have a strong preference either way. But the purpose of that is I get information, enough information about the case to satisfy myself that that's what's going on. And you can, Bob, when you do this for a while, you can kind of spot it across the street. And
Yeah.
so we sort of go through that process and then sort of begin to lay out a strategy. One of the things I've found, at the risk of sounding critical, one of the things I've found is that in terms of preparation for going to court, sometimes there's not a lot of that. And there needs to be, in these cases, there needs to be preparation because you're going to select, it's like I tell people, it's like you have a thousand piece jigsaw puzzle, but you can only use 27 pieces. So you have to select
Right.
the pieces of evidence you're going to present because it typically they fill up boxes and boxes and you only have room for a folder or
You
something
got
like
it.
that.
You got it. Mike, what's your phone number if people wanted to call you?
Sure. 407-645-0662. That's my office number. Leave a voicemail and then it'll in the voicemail it'll say you might want to email me too. And that my email is michael@jmichaelbone.com.
Very good. Mike, thank you. I hope this was helpful
Well,
for people that are listening.
absolutely. Me too, Bob. And I appreciate your time and your work and so forth. So
all right, Mike.
we'll
Take
talk to you
care.
soon. All
Thank
right.
you. Take care. Thank you so much for joining us today. For more information on this topic, please visit www.drbobevans.com or www.naopas.com. We offer classes for both legal and mental health professionals to help educate them on the signs and strategies of parental alienation and how to move forward for a healthier environment for the children of divorce. Please visit www.naopas.com and sign up for our courses and use coupon code PODCAST for a 50% discount.